Today's Teisho will be on case 48 in the Momonkan, Kenpo's One Road. A monk said to Kenpo Osho, "It is written, Bhagavats in the 10 directions, one straight road to Nirvana. I wonder where the road can be." Kenpo lifted his staff, drew a line, and said, "Here it is." Later, the monks asked the same question to Umon, who held up his fan and said, "This fan jumps up to the 33rd heaven and hits the nose of the deity Sakra Devanam Indra. When you strike the carp of the eastern sea, the rain comes down in torrents." Momon's comment, "One going to the bottom of the sea lifts up clouds of dust. The other, on top of the highest mountain, raises towering waves to wash the sky. One holding fast, the other left letting go, each stretches out his hand to support the profound teaching. They are just like two riders starting from opposite ends of the course and meeting in the middle. But none on earth can be absolutely direct. When examined with the true eye, neither of these two great masters knows the road." So I want to thank you very much for coming to practice Zen this morning, on this beautiful spring morning. You know, I think the Zen, obviously, is really something special. I have been doing it for about 40 years, been practicing Zen for about 40 years. And the longer I do it, the more I actually love it. But also the more I realize it's a rather extraordinary thing. You know, everybody in this room got up and came here today to practice, we say in Zen, the great way, to practice the great way. And at the end of it, nobody is going to make a dime, you know. So none of you have made any money this morning. At the end of your Zen training, you won't even have a line you can put on your CV. You know? So when you go for a job interview, you can't really say at the end, "Oh yes, and also I passed all the koans in the Momonkan." Your boss will not, your prospective boss will not be impressed. Right? They'll say, "What's the Momonkan? What's a koan?" And it won't really help you in your professional advancement. It is true that in some temples, there are like titles. There are titles. So somebody's Karmadana, somebody, you know, there's a number of jobs that have to be done in temples. And with those jobs, there is some distinction. But it's very trivial. You know, whether you're this or that, no, it doesn't really amount to much. In fact, you know, it's interesting. In China, it's interesting that nobody in the Zen, in a Zen temple wanted to be the abbot of the Zen temple. Isn't that interesting? So you might imagine that the abbot of the temple, the main teacher, would be a very coveted position. You would think that basically people would all compete, would all be jostling to get to the top of the pyramid of authority and get into the position of being recognized as the abbot of the temple. But actually, in China, that was never the case. Nobody wanted, according to many sources, in everyday Zen life, nobody wanted to be the abbot. People actually had to be sort of dragged into like a 3-year term as abbot, only with great reluctance. And being abbot meant you would go to dinners in the community and people would say what a great Zen master you were, and they would wine and dine you, and everybody would respect you. Nobody wanted that job. Everybody just wanted to do their zazen. Now, I think that's really interesting. You know, in almost every other area of endeavor that I know, people don't behave like that. You know, they really don't. So for example, you would think English professors would be a humble lot, right? Without much concern about worldly recognition. But how wrong you would be, right? People actually spend a lot of time competing with each other, trying to get noticed and trying to get respected. And if people are not acknowledged, they get angry, they become insecure. It's very interesting to see how even in something like an English department that you would think would be relatively immune to this kind of behavior, people compete all the time. Right now, we're in the process of awarding what are called merit salary increases. Merit salary increases. And the way it works is that you can apply for a merit increase in your pay based upon the things you've published and the papers you've given publicly. And you type it all up and it's your CV or your resume, basically. It's another word for it. And you submit it to the head of your department, and there's usually like a secret committee. You elect the members, but they operate secretly. And they go through everybody's CV, everybody's resume, and they actually have a point system. If you've given this many papers, you get 4 points. If you've published this many articles, you get 5 points. And everybody gets tallied up in a point system, and then a list is made because there's a limited pot of money for everybody to get a salary increase. So the people with the most points get the biggest increases, and the people with the least points get the smallest increase or no increase. And I have my friend of mine is actually the chair of the department, and she was saying she's just dreading the day that this comes out. This all comes out, people get notified. She said because nobody in the department is going to be happy. Everybody's going to be unhappy. The people who didn't get very much are going to feel like they've been overlooked, or they'll feel worthless about themselves. And the people at the top will feel they still haven't gotten enough. So she said she's just dreading, she's been dreading this whole process, and she's been dreading the day when the awards are, everybody gets a personal letter from the dean saying this will be your salary increase, if any. And so it's like a formula for unhappiness, but it's how we live in our community. And most places work like this. Most places work like this. You know, it's often the case that people do things because they will get something out of it. They'll get something out of it. And it's unusual, right, for people to do something like Zen practice knowing they're not going to get anything out of it. You know, that's really interesting. Because as I say, you know, you don't get a check at the end of the month for the hours you put in on your cushion, right? And you don't get a line in your resume. I was at a sesshin maybe 30 years ago, and we held the sesshin on a farm owned by one of our members. And one way we could pay him back for allowing us to use his farm for our retreat was for us to go out and work in his garden every day, pull all the weeds. And I was pulling weeds with my teacher, Kangan Roshi. And he was in one row, and I was in another. We were both working towards each other. When we got to the met in the middle, basically, we both sort of paused for a minute, and he said, "Oh, you know, you've really finished your training." That was it. No awards, no merit badge, no ribbon. You're done. So, you know, I think that's just beautiful. In Japan, they actually had you got a document that said you were now finished your training, your Zen training. It's called Inka. And you actually had a little certificate. And one of the teachers in our lineage, actually, when he got his certificate, he set it on fire. I just love that, you know. Just, what is this? So there's something really special about Zen, you know, because we don't make any money, you don't get any recognition, there's no social advancement engaged with this, or attached to this. So you might think, why do people do it? Why do people do it? When people start out doing Zen, sometimes they do have they do see a payoff up in the future. You know, they see a payoff. So, when I started doing Zen, I was 20 years old. And I had heard that a Japanese Zen master named Takabayashi Genki had just come from Ryutakuji. And was now holding a meditation practice near the University of Washington. So I started going to meditation practice, and I had already read a lot about Buddhism and Zen. I remember as a kid looking at National Geographic's. And at National Geographic's, for a kid like me, I was on a military base, and there's nothing to do on a military base. It's a terrible, terrible, boring environment. And at the base club, they had like a place where kids could hang out during the day, teenagers, and so they wouldn't get into too much trouble. And there was a swimming pool, too. They had like a little library, and it was full of National Geographic, so I would read the National Geographic, and there would be pictures of Tibet and Japan, these beautiful Japanese temples and mysterious Tibetan monasteries up on these remote, craggy mountaintops. And I formed this idea that these people must have like miraculous powers, you know? And then I actually had the misfortune, I guess, there was a writer who published some books that were very popular in the 60s and the 50s. And his name was T. Lobsang Rampa. And he claimed to be a Tibetan. And he claimed to be writing about Tibetan society. He was hugely popular. His books sold millions of books. He's disappeared from the face of the earth because it was a giant fraud. But people knew so little about Tibet that T. Lobsang Rampa was hugely popular, and he described monks in Tibet who were able to communicate telepathically with each other. And he made up these stories just that were just ridiculous lies. Like he said that Tibetans traveled across Tibet in big kites. I mean, and no, you know, this was you know, for me, like this, you know, 12-year-old kid on a military base, it was like, oh my God, this is fantastic. So, you know, when I started doing Zen, I really did believe that I was going to get powers, you know, some kind of powers. Now, that sounds ridiculous, but, you know, I was just finishing up my undergraduate education. I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. I had a summer job or a job lined up running a restaurant. And I felt very powerless, you know, powerless, aimless. And when I started doing Zen practice, it seemed to promise me, you know, some control over my life, like powers. I thought maybe I would be able to communicate telepathically with people, or I didn't really know what. I didn't think about it too much, but I definitely thought I was going to get some kind of powers out of doing meditation practice. And when I started training with Genki Roshi, you know, I expected that he would give me like secret teachings, because I had read in books on Tibetan Buddhism that there were these secret teachings, these esoteric teachings that the teacher would give you. And I honestly thought that, I mean, these are sort of fantasies, but they're definitely things we also take somewhat seriously, you know. I definitely thought I would go into Dokusan with Genki Roshi and he would say, okay, here are the secret teachings. And he would give me these teachings, and you know, I had no idea what would happen. I had also been reading these wonderful books by an anthropologist named Carlos Castaneda. And I both recommend and don't recommend those books, because they're incredibly gripping and they're totally untrue, right, actually. And I read those when I was in college. One of them is about an anthropologist who goes to Mexico to study Native American shamanism. And he runs into a shaman whose name is Don Juan. And Don means like a respected person, like sir or mister. And this person turns out to be a Yaqui shaman, a Yaqui visionary, you could say, or a holy man. And he takes Carlos Castaneda on these incredible journeys. And I remember reading these in an anthropology class, because at the time the anthropological people in anthropology really believed these were true. And in the book, people can fly. And at one of the books ends with Carlos Castaneda and his teacher, Don Juan, going to the edge of a cliff in the southwest. And Carlos Castaneda said, I knew that if I jumped off this cliff, I would die. But Don Juan had told me that if I used my powers, I would not die. And at the end of the book, they both jump off the cliff together. Of course, he wrote the book, so he must have survived, right? And these books were hugely popular. Again, you know, this idea of like powers. Anyway, I had read all of this stuff, and I had begun to do Zen because I thought it would give me powers or give me entry into like a mysterious, mystical world. This says something about myself, I guess. And then I began to actually do Zen practice. And, you know, it was a big shock for me to have to get up early in the morning. I started sitting at the Zen Center. And I would get up I was a person who used to get up around 9. And I actually used to pick my courses in college, I'm ashamed to say. I picked them so they were late in the day, so I didn't have to get up too early. All of a sudden I was getting up at like 5:30 in the morning to go do meditation. And I would go into Dokusan, and there weren't any secret teachings. You know, I would go in to see Genki Roshi, and he would say, "Are you watching your breath?" And I was so impatient with being given the breath perception koan, because I wanted the secret teachings. Anybody can watch his breath. Come on. So I would go in to see Genki Roshi, and he'd say, "What's happening with your breath?" And I, you know, so yeah, it's going in, it's going out, you know. And he'd ring a little bell, meaning the interview is over. And this went on for like years. And also, I had a lot of problems sitting physically, you know. So even though now I can sit for a pretty long period of time, when I first started sitting, I had a lot of pain in my legs. They would really throb and hurt. But it seemed I had a very hard time keeping my back straight. And it was just like there was no posture that I could find which was comfortable. And sometimes I would come in and I would sit down on the cushion, and I would be, I tried this posture, and my left leg would hurt. So then I'd switch a little bit, and my right leg would hurt. And then, you know, the pain in my legs would go away, but then I would have this pain in my hip. And then it would be the left hip. Then it would be the right hip. You know, sometimes, when I was in the middle of a sit, I would notice that the perspiration was coming off my body. I was like sweating like a pig. Sweating. And when I would get up, I would just be like a dish rag that you've wrung out. You know, so I had this image in my mind of Zen practice being something mystical or mysterious. And I thought of it as something that would like lift me out of my life, where I didn't feel like I had much power, and take me to a better place, this place that was mysterious and interesting, and where people could communicate telepathically or jump off cliffs. And instead of getting to that place, you know, what I wound up with was sitting on the cushion, sweating and having a lot of pain, and trying to focus on my breath. I didn't really... The strange thing is that I didn't really mind at all, actually. You know, you would think that at some point in all of this process, I would have said, "Hey, this is not what I bargained for, and there's no secret teachings. All I'm doing is sitting on the cushion, and my legs are hurting me." You know, I thought this was one thing. And it's turned out to be something very different. I'm out of here. And indeed, there are many people who get involved in Zen and do make that decision. I've probably talked about this before, but when I was training at the Seattle Zen Center, I used to come in the morning. And eventually I came every morning. And there began to be this group of people, an older man and his sons. I think he had two sons and some friends of the son. And they would all come to sit in the morning. And they sat like rocks. They were really excellent sitters. And after we would sit in the morning at the Zen Center, we would have a breakfast, Japanese breakfast. We would have rice, miso soup, some stir-fried vegetables, and some skimono, some pickles. And then we would go off to our school or to jobs. But some of us would hang out a little while and talk. And it turns out this guy ran a couple of martial arts studios in Seattle, and he was very successful. And he was coming every morning with his sons, and they seemed like the nicest people. Anyway, one time, I can't remember when it was, but maybe we had all gone out to get coffee after the sit. And he brought a book with him to show me. It was a very beautifully published book. It was published in Switzerland. And there was apparently somebody in Switzerland who had all of these photographs of UFOs. And he wrote this book, which was really quite expensive. It was like hundreds of dollars. And he basically had this whole made these claims about how, you know, enlightened Buddhist masters are in contact with aliens. And at this time, you know, I didn't know what to say. You know, I was just stunned that somebody would believe this. And basically, I asked him to go see Genki Roshi, and I think Genki Roshi must have said, I have no contact with aliens, I'm sorry. And the guy stopped coming, and that's the end. I didn't do that. For some reason, you know, I didn't quit. And I think the reason I didn't quit was because this was, in my opinion, this is vastly more valuable and liberating than any kind of special powers, you know. When I started doing Zen, I think I was a really depressed person. And I think one of the reasons I had a lot of fantasies was that I was so depressed. And I began to do meditation every day. I didn't consciously think about it, but I definitely felt better after meditating. You know, I just definitely, I would sit there on the cushion, my legs would hurt, I would be covered with sweat, I would get up, and I would feel happy. After doing Zen practice for about 5 years, I remember reading something about depression and realizing I had been depressed, and also beginning to say, well, when was the last time I felt like this? And I realized it was years ago, you know, it was years in the past. That there was something about Zen practice which lifted me out of my depression and really made me happy. I don't even know if happy is the right word. You know, this is still true. You know, I have a lot of pressures and causes of distress, just like everybody else. And I sit down on the cushion, and, you know, you enter deep samadhi, and it's like you're in a place that is timeless and ageless, and in my opinion, totally free. And then you get off the cushion and you can walk out into the world and none of this bothers you. You know, none of this, eventually, none of this is going to bother you. You know, this is like, I think, worth much more than being able to fly, you know, or being able to jump off a cliff and land and not be killed. It's really the most important thing. You know, the whole system that we live in encourages people to look for, you know, you could say, like, powers, right? Right now we're in election for president. And it's a little bit depressing to see the election. I don't just mean Donald Trump. That's depressing, of course. And that requires a lot of zazen to deal with Trump. But even with Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, you know, if you go on Facebook and you have access to my Facebook page, you know that I am a big Bernie Sanders fan. And I would love to see him become president of the United States. And I actually have a lot of problems with Mrs. Clinton. I don't think she always backs the right side in many arguments. But it's been interesting to see how heated the exchanges between the Bernie people and the Hillary people have become. Like very, very angry exchanges. And it's interesting to see how each side looks at their champion, right? So, you know, I was online looking for something about Bernie Sanders. I Googled his name, and I found that there's a very popular website that has Bernie Sanders dressed as Obi-Wan Kenobi from Star Wars. And they've pasted somebody's, you know, photoshopped his face into over Alec Guinness's face. This has gotten tens of thousands of hits, you know. You know, what are people looking from Bernie? You know, I have to tell you, I will vote for Bernie Sanders if he runs. I think he's a great guy, but he's not Obi-Wan Kenobi. You know, he's not. There's a lot of wishful thinking going into that. You know, so they're turning Bernie Sanders into like this savior figure. And of course, Hillary becomes like what? Palpatine or something like that. You know, the very evil person. And Hillary's people are also doing the same thing to Bernie Sanders. You know, I read Salon.com, and you can see the letters. If it's a pro-Hillary article, the letters from the Bernie people are just incredibly angry, and the letters from if it's a pro-Hillary article, the letters from the Bernie people are angry. There's so much wishful thinking involved in all this, and so much illusion, and also people feel, I think, very powerless. We feel this like in our political lives, in our everyday lives. You know, we feel this in our financial lives. Lots of people. I have a one of my assistants at work. Just got out of college, and she started talking about how much college debt she had, and she actually started crying. And she just said, "I feel so powerless, right?" And so, you know, we all want to, like, we want control. We want to solve this problem by getting control. And I think one of the reasons the elections are so heated is because, you know, everybody feels powerless, and everybody has this fantasy of control. You know, if Bernie Sanders becomes president, I would love to see that happen, but things will not change very much, actually, because, you know, it's hard to make change. And if Bernie Sanders becomes president, we won't have universal health care tomorrow, even though I'd like to see that happen, because he has to get that through Congress, etc., right? And if Mrs. Clinton becomes president, same thing, you know, not much is going to happen. I hope it's true, even if Trump becomes president, there's only so much damage he can do. It's very hard to make change. None of these people will really have the power we wish they had, and that we wish we had, you know. So lots of things we do are motivated by a sense of powerlessness, which is not an illusion, you know. We grow up feeling powerless, and lots of the times we make decisions based on the desire to be safer, more powerful, have more control over our lives, and so on. You know, but I think that what is so liberating about Zen practice is that it's really not about acquiring power of any kind. You know, when we sit down on the cushion, we can't control anything. You know, you can't. You can come in on the and sit down on the cushion and get into the perfect posture. You can straighten your back. You can pull your legs up. You can breathe through your hara, and you can have a crummy sit. You know, your mind is full of distracting thoughts. You know, sometimes you come in and you sit down on the cushion, you don't expect anything, and you enter deep samadhi, and you feel totally wonderful. You know, one of the lessons of Zen is that this is not about control. It's a different relationship. You know, different relationship. There was a very famous Japanese Zen teacher named Shinichi Hisamatsu. And he created a koan for which he became rather famous. It's called, "What Do You Do When There's Nothing You Can Do?" And Hisamatsu had been had grown up during the period of the Japanese military aggression against China during prior to World War II. And his family had really been against Japanese militarization and against the invasion of China. And he had grown up with this, you know, basically feeling trapped in Japanese culture. And that had gotten him interested in Zen practice. He went to Germany and studied philosophy and so on. But he created this koan, what do you do when there's nothing you can do? There's another story that I'd like to tell about this. You know, some of you might have had the chance to read Peter Matheson's wonderful book, The Snow Leopard. You know, basically, Peter Matheson goes to look for this very famous lama and finds him in this remote place. Meets the Lama, and so on and so on. But at the center of the story is their attempt to find a snow leopard. That's hence the title of the book. He's in the Tibetan Plateau, on the Tibetan Plateau, looking for snow leopard. And all throughout the book, they find prints of the snow leopard. They find scat or defecation from the snow. They never find, at the end of the book, they never find the snow leopard. And all this time, Matthiessen is also practicing his meditation, his meditation practice. And he has kind of a breakthrough in the course of the story. And you know, he says, "I never found the snow leopard. Isn't that wonderful?" Not to find what you're looking for is actually the most liberating thing in the world. That might seem hard to understand, but Zen is very much about that. You know, beyond what we would like to have happen, there's something which is really much more wonderful than that. You know, all this time I was practicing Zen, looking for powers. I was deepening my concentration, and I was entering a state of consciousness that was really different from this grasping mind that's always trying to protect itself or advance its situation. And, you know, when I would get off the cushion, I would feel so alive, and nothing had changed. I still had student debt. I was still making $3.75 an hour. I was still running a restaurant, or I was still moving furniture. But something had changed. It's like a bigger life. Bigger life. You know, everybody is well aware that Prince, probably you're well aware, that Prince, the musician Prince, died this week, just a few days ago. And a number of other people have died this year. David Bowie died, and believe it or not, a number of people I know personally have died, like really unexpectedly. I also know some people who are actually in the process of probably dying. And, it's so interesting to talk to people whose lives are coming to an end, because their perspective is so different. You know, it's much closer to like a Zen perspective, often. You know, it doesn't, at some point, it doesn't matter. Some of the things that we care so much about, that causes so much emotional distress, when you reach a certain point in your life, you realize they were utterly unimportant. You know, the most precious things in the world are those moments when we get outside of ourselves and we feel connected to like a bigger life, bigger life. You know, and at those moments, you know, sometimes it only happens to people when they're at the end of their life, but in those moments we realize it really doesn't matter if the committee, the promotion committee, gave us 5 points or 15 points. You know, that's utterly unimportant. If you live in that world, you're destined to be unhappy all the time, no matter how successful you are. And if you live in this other world, you know, if you practice the great way and you learn how to step outside of your small self, everything becomes, as one koan puts it, everything becomes like your rice. Everything is nourishing to you. Everything is revitalizing to you. A monk said to Kenpo Osho, "It is written, Bhagavats are like gods or holy beings. It is written, there are Bhagavats in the 10 directions." This is like the 8 compass points and up and down, basically. The 10, in Indian people think in the 10 directions, there's the 8 points of the compass, but there's also zenith and nadir, up and down. It is written, there are Bhagavats in the 10 directions, one straight road to nirvana. So this life is all of these different options, but there's just one road to nirvana, it is said. Where is that road? See, this is where is that road? Kenpo lifted his staff, drew a line, and said, it's right here. In other words, it's right where I am. The road is right where I'm going, wherever I'm going. You can't tell where your life is going to be. You know, Prince just went on the road. He was 57. Most people don't die at 57. He had gotten his band together. He was on the road. He was going to make a tour, world tour. He was going to be back in the public eye, and he died. You know, there's not a person in this room who can say where he or she will be in a year. That's the truth. You know, nobody has that kind of control. And isn't that wonderful? See, isn't that wonderful? Zen is about not having control. Kenpo lifted his staff, drew a line, and said, here it is. Later, the monks asked the same question of Umon. Umon held up his fan and said, this fan jumps up to the 33rd heaven and hits the nose of the deity Sakradevanan Indra. When you strike the carp of the eastern sea, the rain comes down in torrents. So, you know, most of the time, we identify with the me, That's the way ordinary consciousness works. You know, we get up in the morning and we say, what do we want, what do I want for breakfast? You know, oatmeal or yogurt? Which kind of coffee? You know, regular coffee or coffee with hazelnut? And so on and so on. This is how we live our lives. But if you don't live that way, you know, you have to sort of live that way, I admit. You know, you have to plan, you have to get up, you have to set your alarm clock. But when you come in and you sit down, it's possible to step out of that small self and participate, we would say, in the life of the universe. Become one with the whole universe. The whole universe becomes your body. So if you're in that state, you know, yes, you have student debt. Yes, you know, this is a problem. Yes, this is a problem. If you sit down on the cushion and you enter that state, you know, this fan jumps up to the 33rd heaven and hits the nose of the deity Sakradevanan Indra. There are no bound, as we say, in the Shinshin Ming that we recite every morning, no boundaries are seen. Mumon's comment, one going to the bottom of the sea lifts up clouds of dust. The other, on top of the highest mountain, raises towering waves to wash the sky. One holding fast, the other letting go, each stretches out his hand to support the profound teaching. They are just like two riders starting from opposite ends of the course and meeting in the middle. But none on earth can be absolutely direct. When examined with a true eye, neither of these great masters knows the road. So remember, in Zen, when Mumon wants to pay you a compliment, he says you're an idiot and you don't know what you're talking about. So here he's actually saying these are two great enlightened masters. Mumon's verse, before a step is taken, the goal is already reached. See, that's what we discover in Zazen. Before a step is taken, the goal is already reached. Before the tongue is moved, the speech is already finished. Though each move is ahead of the next, there is still a transcendent secret.